Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, the topic today is an update on what's been going on the past week since the crash of Silicon Valley Bank. What's happening to the larger banking system in the U.S. and globally here? You know, sometimes it's worthwhile to step back and let things happen a little bit to see, you know, what's really going on, let the dust settle. And I think after a week, it's interesting to see what's actually going on in the different sectors in the U.S. and globally here. So today's show will give an update on the banking instability in the wake of the Silicon Valley Bank collapse a week ago, right? What actually happened at Silicon Valley Bank? What was the process of its collapse? And is that process at work in other banks and banking sectors here, particularly the regional banks, the smaller regional banks in the U.S., that were deregulated from even the weak Dodd-Frank bill? You know, Dodd-Frank Act was passed in 2010. Remember that? Supposedly to prevent any similar banking instability. Well, people weren't aware probably that at the same time it was passed, the Obama administration agreed to give 5 years before they would implement Dodd-Frank, during which the banks just picked it apart. Right. And then the coup de grace was given in 2018 for the smaller regional banks like Silicon Valley Bank when they exempted it totally from Dodd-Frank. So there's been no regulation of these small banks like Silicon Valley Bank ever since. And even Dodd-Frank and the big banks, you know, the big five, six, we're talking about Chase and Wells and so forth. Even they, the stress test every year the Fed does for the big banks as a result of Dodd-Frank is phony. The Fed tells them beforehand exactly what numbers they got to come up with in order to pass the test. Yeah, so it's, you know, it's a farce, really. They just move their capital around temporarily to satisfy the Fed, and then they redirect it wherever they want, the big banks. So the banking regulation is a joke here, and it's not surprising that we have the same thing now happening. Instead of the housing sector and banks that overinvested and speculated in the housing sector back in 2006 to 2008, now we got the tech sector, right? The tech sector is the leading edge in all this, right? What's been the solution so far this past week by the Fed and the big banks to try to stabilize the regional banks' instability here that's emerged since the crash of Silicon Valley Bank, right? What are the indicators, three indicators that are show the continuing instability and likely problems at a particular bank? We'll talk about that today. What's happening with Credit Suisse over in Europe? Is the U.S. Silicon Valley Bank and regional banks instability causing more stress over there in Europe? With Credit Suisse in particular as the focus. What are the similarities and differences with the 2008 crisis? What does this mean for the Fed policy of hiking rates next week? We're going to get another Fed rate hike, which is the key, according to the Fed, to slow inflation. And what's the consequences for the real economy of this banking instability, particularly if it worsens? Okay, so those are the topics we're going to try to address here in today's show. A lot to talk about to understand what's going on. Well, you know, to understand what's going on, you got to go back a little bit in history here, at least a decade or so, because there are similarities to what happened in 2008. There's significant differences, some of them, you know, positive, some of them negative to what happened in 2008. But take the case of Silicon Valley Bank. What happened to Silicon Valley Bank? Well, you know, tech, during the COVID crash, tech just blew right through it. Didn't affect tech's profits and revenues and investments and so forth. The whole industry just overextended during COVID. And now we see it contracting. And, of course, we see it in the banking sector related to tech and startups here with Silicon Valley Bank. But it's in general. And you can see some indications, you know, the big four, the big evil corp four, you know, Meta, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, Amazon, right? I call them the evil four. You know, now they're all laying off. So this thing shows that tech is in trouble, and now it's the tip of the iceberg on the financing part of tech. That's Silicon Valley Bank. You know, SVB financed at least half of all the tech startups in the U.S. It was 16th largest bank, not a small bank, right? It collapsed. It was the second largest commercial bank collapse in history in the U.S., only slightly behind the collapse of Washington Mutual in 2008, another commercial bank. Right? So not small potatoes here in the case of Silicon Valley Bank. What actually happened there that caused it to go under? And is that a template for what's, you know, in different stages occurring with other banks? Okay, so what happened? Well, what happened is Silicon Valley Bank, you know, riding the boom and getting all this startup money from VCs and so forth being deposited in Silicon Valley Bank. And, you know, a lot of stockholders got rich during the boom and put their money in Silicon Valley Bank depositors. Right. Investors invested in the bank, bought its bonds and stocks. Individuals put their money, their deposits in the bank. The VCs funding for a lot of their startups, you know, the money was put in the bank. But the real boost in overinvesting by SVB came during COVID. If you look at its total value of its assets in 2019, before COVID, about $50 billion. By the end of 2022, when we have this latest speculative boom in tech, the total assets will reach $200 billion. So they go from $50 billion to $200 billion, right? Again, retail small depositors put their money in, VCs put their money in. But what happened was the Fed reduced interest rates when COVID hit to zero. I mean, they kept them pretty much at zero from 2008 until about 2016, 17. The Fed tried to raise interest rates for about a year or so, but Trump stepped on the Fed and forced the Fed to return to a zero interest rate policy for 2018 and 19. And then the crash came, the COVID crash, and the Fed pumped another $5 trillion into the economy. Oh, by issuing bonds that were super, super cheap. In other words, you can get a government bond, an investor, and it hardly costs you anything. Now, if you're a bank and you buy bonds from the government, right, what you're doing is adding to your reserve requirements, your reserves, more collateral. You use the treasuries as collateral. And that means that you, with your collateral increases, you can then issue far more loans and you can, you know, you got so much money that you can loan out that you then turn to high risk taking loans. And that's what SVB did. It loaded up on treasuries and it loaded up on high risk loans. And like a lot of other tech and companies in general, it bought you know, treasuries. It took on more treasury debt because the interest rate was so low. I mean, take the case of Apple. Apple had $252 billion in profits when before COVID hit, right? What did it do? It borrowed money, massively borrowed money from the Fed, bought bonds at cheap rate, you know, near zero rate, didn't cost them anything. It turned around and used that money to reward its shareholders, right? It gave dividends and stock buybacks and so forth, and the shareholders got filthy rich. Billionaires were created, and that's what happened everywhere. During Trump, about $4 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts just by the Fortune 500 companies occurred. Why? Because they were borrowing money from the Fed and just turning around and giving it to their shareholders, and sitting on their huge profits. You know, they don't want to use their profits to give to their shareholders. They just borrowed the money. The point is, SVB loaded up on treasuries at near zero rate. Now, here comes the Fed in 2022, a year ago, and starts raising interest rates, no longer at zero, raise those interest rates at a record pace, you know, from zero to almost 5% in just in a matter of months. Now, when treasuries and bond yields in general, yields, rate increases, rise, what that means is the price of those bonds go in the opposite direction. They fall. So here you've got Silicon Valley Bank and other tech banks in the tech sector loaded up on treasuries. 2021, you know, the Fed pumps $5 trillion in treasury sales and money into the economy. They load up on treasuries. And now when the Fed starts raising rates, the value of those treasuries, those bonds, collapse. When it collapses, their balance sheet, in other words, the picture of how well they're doing, goes into the red. In other words, they're below water, right? Because the value, just the dollar, you know, the paper value collapses as interest rates rise. So what happens is Silicon Valley Bank tried to fill that hole. What did it do? It tried to sell some of the bonds that it had, but with rates rising and everything, no one wanted to buy the bonds now from Silicon Valley Bank at less than their full value. So the bond sale was a bust. SVB actually lost $2 billion on the bond sale. Well, you know, the credit rating agencies like Moody's see this and, you know, already you guys were overextended and now you botched your bond sale. Oh, we're going to lower your credit rating. Whoa, well, that, you know, sends red flags up to other investors and depositors. Oh, something is wrong maybe at SVB because their credit rating is going to go down. Oh, why were they trying to raise money with a bond sale? Maybe there's something wrong. This is what depositors and investors are thinking, you know? And they start looking at the balance sheet, you know? And they look at it and, wow, you know, Silicon Valley's got $200 billion in assets, but wait a minute, you know, $150 billion of that is over the 250,000 FDIC assurance. In other words, if you lose money at FDIC at a bank that goes bust, the FDIC will reimburse you, but only 250,000, almost three quarters or more of the assets and deposits were not insured by the FDIC. So, you know, put yourself in the position of an investor and a depositor. You know, all of a sudden, oh, the bond sale doesn't work, and oh, Moody's is going to downgrade them, and you start looking at its balance sheet and say, oh, gee, my money isn't insured. You know, I got 500,000. You know, meaning I'm a startup company. Maybe I'm just a startup company and I put the money the VC gave me in Silicon Valley Bank and Silicon Valley Bank looks like it's in trouble. Oh, gee, I better look at the balance sheet a little more closely. Oh, you know, gee, it doesn't look too stable. And then I get a call from my VC. You know, I'm a startup. I get a call from my VC and the VC says, get your money out of SVB. Get it out. because it doesn't look good. Well, what happens? Withdrawals. All of a sudden, they're withdrawing money. Investors are withdrawing money. Depositors are withdrawing money from SVB. SVB panics and goes to Goldman Sachs and says, well, let's see if we can raise some money and capital to fill this hole because, you know, we got a big leak and it's gushing here. They try to raise capital by issuing more stock at the last minute. But the thing is moving so fast that the FDIC jumps in before that can happen and seizes Silicon Valley Bank. And game over, right? Game over. Oh, that's the process that happened. And, you know, other banks, particularly those exposed by tech, are in the same situation to some degree. Not maybe to the extreme that Silicon Valley Bank was, you know, but its depositors, which are, you know, wealthy people in Silicon Valley, not just the startups themselves, not just the VCs, right? And then there's investments that the Silicon Valley Bank was already involved in, you know, multiple reasons of sources for their capital, which is dropping in value. The Fed, in other words, precipitates the situation. The Fed helps create the situation by throwing all this easy money and treasuries at these companies in 2020 with COVID, you know, throws $5 trillion, you know, the banks weren't even in trouble then, and it threw $5 trillion at them. Oh, they might get in trouble with COVID, right? Unlike in 2008, where the banks were in trouble and they threw $4 trillion. And once you throw that money out, it doesn't come back. I don't care what they say, right? And it's sloshing around and causing financial speculation and bubbles and so forth. Well, the bubble in tech is what we're talking about here. So to what extent is this process that I talked about, collapsing financial asset values, treasuries, and so forth, which forced the bank to go and raise capital, and thus get money to fill the hole. If it doesn't do it quick, you got depositors, investors getting skittish, and getting their money out. And then you got a bank run. You see, this is a classic bank run. I don't care what some people on the left have been saying, oh, it's not a bank run. Yes, it's a classic bank run, commercial bank run. That happened at SVB. We haven't seen that since 1930s, you know. And it typically, when you have a banking crisis, it occurs in the small and regional banks first. That's where it occurs. In 2008, it occurred in the shadow banks, the investment banks, right? Investment banks, hedge funds, you know, that sector, unregulated at the time. And once again, unregulated here, these regional banks, they were, you know, exempted by Trump. And the Democrats voted for it too, right? Exempt the small regional banks. In fact, you know, the big advocate of, we need banking regulation back in 2008, then Congressman Barney Frank, right? Big advocate of banking regulation. He goes over to a small regional bank, gets big bucks, and it becomes a big proponent of exempting the regional banks in 2018, you know, that Trump wanted. Revolving doors. You know, that's the problem with regulation. The regulatory agents are captured by the industry, in this case, the banking industry, right? So what we got here is a scenario with SVB, and the question is, to what extent is it going on elsewhere? Well, you know, to stem the crisis, what is the Fed doing? The Fed is throwing money at it. Well, wait a minute, isn't it a source of the problem? The Fed throwing too much liquidity, $9 trillion since 2008. Yeah, that's the ultimate source because it, you know, when you get so much money capital on hand, you got to move it. You got to make it work. And there's only so many good, solid investments. And pretty soon you start speculating with that money in the financial asset markets, which are very unstable. That's what SVB did. And other banks do it all the time. Too much money. And then you bail them out and you create what's called moral hazard. SVB and others, you know, they feel that the Fed will there. It'll bail us out. You know, we're too big to fail, right? Well, the Fed bailed out the depositors this time, but it hasn't bailed out the investors who invested in SVB stock and bonds. How much of a loss are they going to take? And what will be the dampening effect throughout the whole tech startup financing industry? It will be significant. The next 3 months is going to shut down. You know, no money for startups, new startups, no money. It's going to shut down. And we don't know how much the rest of the banking system is going to hunker down and hoard its cash. They're probably going to do that to wait and see whether this thing spreads even further. So, you know, bank lending is going to take a big hit here, which means the real economy is going to take a big hit from this as well. So we got this scenario, you know, this whole process I just described of what happened with Silicon Valley Bank. And the question is, how much is this scenario occurring in other banks? Well, the bank that came close to failing as well in a similar scenario was San Francisco's First Republic Bank, which also invested in tech and startups with significant degree. You know, on the West Coast, the banks are very much big funders of West Coast Silicon Valley and the tech industry. First Republic, it looked like it too was going to go the way of SVB. What did the Fed do? Well, the Fed got together with the big four, actually the big six commercial banks. You know, Chase, Wells Fargo, Citi, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. Those are the big six. The first four are commercial banks. The other two are investment banks, shadow banks, but they're big, right? They got together and they put up $30 billion to save the one bank, First Republic. Yeah. In other words, they put a consortium together of private banks to try to, you know, staunch and calm depositors and investors and prevent them from pulling out their deposits and their investments, withdrawing funds, you see, because when you withdraw funds, it has the same effect of collapsing bond prices. In other words, their asset base of the bank declines, just as if, you know, the bond prices decline. Withdrawals make it worse and feed off of the asset declines. And withdrawals cause the assets, the stocks and the bonds value to collapse even more. It becomes a vicious downward cycle of collapsing values on the balance sheet of the institution, which then generates even more fear and withdrawals. You see how it just keeps spiraling down until the whole thing goes under in a particular bank. Well, they threw $30 billion at First Republic about a day or two ago. What's been the response? First Republic stock price is still falling. It's not enough. And it usually isn't enough, you know, initially. And they got to throw more in. This always happens in banking panics, right? Going back to, I did some studies of the 1907 financial banking panic, and the same thing happened. And ironically, it was J.P. Morgan that led a private consortium to bail out a bank in New York that overinvested, speculated in the key technology of the day, which was copper. Because, copper was necessary for all the new machinery that was being, electrical machinery that was being built at the time. You know, copper and machinery in 1907 was the tech of the day at that time, you know, the tech startups of the day. Anyway, I don't want to do too much in terms of comparison, but in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes in 2017, published, I provided a bit of a history of that. And also in my book, Alexander Hamilton and the Origins of the Fed, looking at 19th century U.S. panics and crashes and depressions that followed. And what happened in 1907 was a panic that almost became a depression. It became what I call an epic recession, which is not a normal recession, but not quite yet a depression. Anyway, I don't want to go in too much into that, but if you're interested in what, you know, this process that typically happens in financial crashes, you know, either take a look at my Alexander Hamilton and the Origins of the Fed, or my Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes. By the way, in that book in 2017, I predicted what was going to happen here. And in the past year, I've been saying on this show and in my on my blog, jackrasmus.com, I've been saying that the Fed cannot raise interest rates above 5%. Because if it does, it's going to precipitate a financial panic. The system's going to fracture and crack somewhere. And voila, isn't that exactly what's happening? Yeah. I've said that, you know, for the past year. Because in the 21st century, you have a financialized and globalized capitalist economy unlike ever before. And that means that a lot of speculation in financial assets and creating new assets and derivatives and all of this financial securities going on, and a lot of the Fed injections of liquidity during crises goes right back into the financial markets, causes bubbles in those financial markets, and feeds the next financial crisis. The Fed solution in the short run to throw money at this thing to calm the markets and slow it down, staunch the bleeding, is the basis of generating the next financial crisis. The solution in the short run is the cause of the problem in the long run. That's the problem with monetary policy, capitalist monetary policy today. Okay, so I talked about, you know, what are the indicators of these other regional banks? You want to know if your bank's in trouble? Well, there's three things you can look at to identify if it's in trouble. What are those? Well, first of all, are there withdrawals going on above the historical average? Are people taking their money out, right? That's one. The other is the stock price in free fall? Is it collapsing? Well, we see in the case of First Republic, again, the stock price is falling. That's a strong indicator the bank's in trouble because it indicates people are pulling their money out of it, right? The third indicator is what's the cost of what's called credit default swaps, which are insurance contracts on whether the bank will fail or not. Well, if it looks likely that the bank is going to fail, the cost of buying credit default swaps, CDS as they'll call them, right, rises significantly and rapidly. Credit default swaps cost. In other words, are you going to be able to get your money from a third party that's willing to take a bet by you that the bank will fail, right? I mean, it's a casino, right? CDSs are, you know, what they call a derivative. It's a financial security based upon another security, a derivative, right? Now, a little history here. You go back to 2008 and the crash. Investors had, you know, hedged themselves by buying CDSs on Lehman Brothers, right? Because it looked like Lehman Brothers' stock price was falling over the summer. Something's wrong at Lehman Brothers. Well, what was wrong at Lehman Brothers was it bought into too much of the housing sector, and the price of those assets began to collapse, and therefore its balance sheet began to collapse. And when, as I say, people, investors see that, they start withdrawing their funds, their stock price falls further, et cetera. Well, you know, if you had money in Lehman Brothers, you bought CDSs to protect it, to insure it. Well, Lehman Brothers went under. The government let it go under. Big mistake, right? And the investors in Lehman Brothers said to the source which they bought these CDSs, which was AIG, the biggest insurance company in the United States, AIG, they bought these contracts, the CDS derivative contracts, on the failure of Lehman Brothers. And Lehman went under, and they went to AIG, and they said, well, give us our money. You know, we bought these CDSs from you. You, AIG, you owe us this money now. Lehman went under. And AIG said, gee, we're sorry. We don't have the money to pay you, right? We wrote too many CDSs that we couldn't back up. We didn't think that Lehman was going to collapse, you know. Well, then AIG went under. And had to be bailed out big time by the U.S. government eventually, right? So the question is, look at the CDS prices of insuring against that particular bank. Are the CDS contracts rising rapidly? Are they high, too high, you know, very high? Are withdrawals occurring? Is the stock price falling? Those are all indicators whether the bank is still in trouble. And First Republic Bank is still in trouble. That's $30 billion. Yeah. So that strategy by the Fed to get these big banks together, you know, to bail out their smaller cousins, does not appear to be working that well. We'll see. You know, maybe First Republic stock price will level off and rise again. No one knows for sure here. But throwing money at saving a bank may not convince the depositors and the investors not to continue to withdraw their investments, you know, their cash out of the bank. It may not be enough, you know. Well, apparently it's not enough in the case of First Republic and the investors and depositors. You know, $30 billion, they're not convinced that it's the end of the crisis there. And this process is going on in scores of other smaller regional banks around the country now, behind the scenes, in the background, right? It can erupt to the surface at any time, really. We're in a very ongoing situation here, the consequences of which are still just, unfolding here. So those are the three indicators to watch. Now, what's happened here with the instability, the banking instability, not just in the U.S., but elsewhere. Well, you got to jump across the Atlantic, and you got to look at Credit Suisse Bank, right? Credit Suisse Bank, big bank in Switzerland, one of the big European banks, in trouble. Now, you got to understand that Credit Suisse was in trouble for the past 2 years, right? And in other words, it made some bad, risky investments in a hedge fund called Archegos. I think it was 2021, somewhere around there. And Archegos went under, and Credit Suisse had big losses, and it looked like it speculated with investors and depositors, investors' money. So big investors began to pull out of Credit Suisse, which made it worse for Credit Suisse. And the Swiss government and other big banks, you know, were trying to put Humpty Dumpty Credit Suisse back together again, and they patched it up here last year. They got some investors to say, okay, we're going to commit some money back to Credit Suisse, and Credit Suisse comes up with this three-year plan of how we're going to make money, and we're going to expand over to Asia because there's a lot of possibility for wealth management investing over in Asia. You know, they had this plan together, and it looked like they had put this ramshackle solution together, and were, you know, just hoping. Credit Suisse was held together by a string and chewing gum, right? So it looked like they had put it on a road at least to maybe a recovery. And then you get the banking crisis in the U.S., right? And you get this psychology that, oh, the banks may be in trouble, which becomes a factor. Even if it's irrational, maybe if your bank is not in trouble, but you see other banks failing and you don't believe what your bank CEOs are telling you, because they're going to tell you always they're not in trouble, right? You start pulling your money out, and what was a stable bank now becomes an unstable bank because of the psychology here of investors that occurs. Now, you got to understand what's different today, too, is technology that causes these bank runs to happen at light speed, right? You know, in the 1930s, when the bank was, rumor got around that your bank was in trouble, people went down to the bank and pounded on the door saying, let us in, we want our money, right? And they kept the doors locked. Well, you know, today, what does it take to move your money out of a bank? It takes an iPhone and a wire transfer. You can do it, you know, almost instantaneously. And that was happening in Silicon Valley Bank. The money was flooding out beginning to flood out from these other regional banks. And where was it going? It was going into the big six, right? Chase and so forth. Their deposits really surged as a result of the collapse, well, decline of deposits in the tech and regional banks, right? So, you know, technology is a factor now. And that's also exacerbates the crisis. It makes the contagion move faster than would otherwise be the case. And we're seeing that. That's what's different today. What's different today from 2008 is what's happening is the bubble is bursting not in the housing but in the tech sector. Right. And it's happening in commercial banks. Commercial banks mean banks where that takes depositors' money. You know, when Bear Stearns collapsed in March 2008 and some of the other banks collapsed, these were shadow banks. These were investment banks where only the rich people put their money in and other banks put their money in these investment banks. They didn't have a depositor base. Now it's more risky because there's a depositor base and the government has to move very quickly to bail out the depositors. But the fear factor is so great that people aren't convinced yet that the bailout has succeeded, and they want to protect their money. So they keep moving it out and keep moving it around. You know, get it out of these small regional banks. I don't believe what they say. I'm just to be safe. You know, this is my life savings, or, you know, this is what I was going to use to start up my company and so forth. I'm not going to take the risk. I'm going to take it out, right? It takes a lot to staunch that and that fear and that outflow, right? So back to Credit Suisse, right? What happened with Credit Suisse as a result of what's happening here in the U.S. is the fear jumped the Atlantic, right? And depositors and investors who last year kind of took a risk and reluctantly said, okay, we'll help Credit Suisse get back on track here. We'll put some money in it. Those investors changed their mind. And they said last week, we're not going to put our money in. Nope, we're not going to do it. Whoa, you know, we're back to crisis here for Credit Suisse. They don't have money capital that was supposed to come in, doesn't come in. Oh, they're going to have to sell more equity, more stock. Well, who wants to buy stock in a company, a bank, whose stock price is falling, right? Oh, so that becomes difficult. So Credit Suisse, and the rumor is, went to the Saudis and said, Saudi, will you buy some of us? And the Saudis said, nope, we're not going to invest in Credit Suisse because its stock price, you know, obviously is falling. But why should they do it as the stock price is falling? Why should they try to catch a falling knife, as they say, right? They're going to wait until the knife hits the floor and the stock price is zero. If then they jump in and buy, and they'll probably just buy the best assets in Credit Suisse or the Swiss National Bank, Central Bank, and the Swiss government will force Credit Suisse to merge with probably UBS, the other big Swiss bank. That's more likely what's going to happen. But it means that Credit Suisse is toast, right? As I've been saying, you look at their credit default swaps 2 days ago, they were 36%. In other words, for each dollar you had, it cost you 36% to insure it, right? Credit default swap cost rising is an indicator of the degree of the crisis and the instability and the bank stock price falling as well. And withdrawals by big investors and small investors, bank run, are indicators of what's going on there. When Credit Suisse falls here, collapses. The question is, what's going to be, the psychology of contagion fear that's going to spread? Well, other banks in Europe, and there's some weak sisters over there. I think, Barclays, Societe Generale in France, Barclays in England, I haven't looked. But there's other banks in trouble. Not as much trouble as Credit Suisse, because Credit Suisse, did its dumb move back a year or so ago with investing in the fraudulent Archegos that collapsed, Archegos hedge fund that collapsed. So it was already, it was the Silicon Valley Bank of Europe, you see, except there's a big commercial bank. So we don't know what's going to happen when it unwinds here. And we don't know what's going to happen here when the First Republic Bank stock price should continue to fall. Certainly $30 billion is not enough. And certainly the $54 billion that had been pledged by investing in Credit Suisse that got pulled out was not enough. Right. How much is enough? No one knows for sure what it's going to take to stop the fear psychology here. But we know it's not enough, right? So the Fed's going to have to make some more moves. Now, what the Fed has also done, in addition to getting this private consortium with Chase and others to try to bail out First Republic before it crashes, what the Fed has also done is opened what's called its discount window. That's a borrowing facility that you can go to in the Federal Reserve and borrow liquidity, get liquidity short term. Put it on your balance sheet and say, hey, look, we've got plenty of cash here. Don't take your money out, right? We got all this money capital. Of course, they borrow from the Fed and you have to pay it back sometime. So that discount window, as it's called, is one of the vehicles for bailout that the Fed has at its disposal here, and not just the $30 billion from the consortium, private sectors. Well, let's look at the discount window as an indicator of the scope of the banking instability, maybe. Prior to the crash of SVB, banks were borrowing, on average, the week before, $4.8 billion from the discount window. How much did he buy or borrow last week? $165 billion. Whoa, they're all rushing to the Fed discount window, grabbing that money, putting it on their balance sheet, saying to their investors and depositors, oh, look, we're okay. We got all this cash. Yeah, our stock price might be falling and, our asset prices, our bonds, treasuries that we took from the Fed because it was so cheap 2 years ago, may be falling in value, but it's just paper value. And we got all this liquidity that we got from the Fed. We're okay, but they're going to have to pay that back at some point, and they won't be okay. And investors and depositors know that, what else can the Fed do? It's got instrument called the repo, reverse repurchase agreements, where it can provide collateral through bonds to banks, right? That's another vehicle it can use. And then if things really get bad, the FDIC can just take them over, and we have what we got with Silicon Valley Bank. Immediately, the depositors are bailed out, and the FDIC sets up this special bank on the side that they put the remaining assets of any value of the failed bank in. That's what's happened with SVB. The Fed set up this parallel bank. Sometimes it's called a bad bank. In other words, take the assets and put it in this bank, so the Fed has control over how it gets distributed, and there's no more fraud going on. The Fed can do that. It can open up the spigot, as it has, even further. Not just the discount window. It is committed $25 billion through this special bank lending facility. As in 2008, they created all these special lending facilities for the different segments of the banking financial system that they can go and borrow. In other words, virtually get free money capital for a time to put on their balance sheets to try to convince investors and depositors they're okay. Well, the Fed has created $25 billion. Initially, in that bank lending facility, it can just increase that, say, okay, $100 billion, $200 billion, right? I mean, after all, you know, it pumped $5 trillion in 2020 into the whole system. It'll throw as much money as it needs to, and it will keep upping that ante if it looks like that the banking instability is beginning to spread or is continuing. You can expect that from the Fed, right? The other thing the Fed is going to do now, and I predict, is not going to raise interest rates more than 0.25% next week. And then it's going to hold off watching the instability of the banking system. You see, because there's a big contradiction here. Raising interest rates, right, causes the financial system to fracture. You know, we're seeing it in the tech and the regional banks, right? As I predicted the past year, can't get it above 5%. You know, it's interesting that the whole process at SVB kind of went into high gear here right after Fed Chairman Powell spoke to Congress, and the word started getting around that the Fed felt its interest rate hikes to date wasn't really bringing inflation down very much, and it would have to raise its rates to 6%. That's called the terminal rate, right? Up to 6%. That's what was bouncing around before SVB collapsed, and that was kind of the message that the Fed Chairman Powell gave to Congress a day before SVB began to unravel. Oh, it's going to go 6%, right? Well, 6%, you know, it's at roughly 5% now, maybe 4.755%, between 5.1 or somewhere around there, right? Going to 6%, that was enough, you know, to add fuel to the fire and set the process of SVB in motion here. You know, investors and depositors realize that, interest rates are going to continue to go high. That means the balance sheet and the bond and stock value at SVB was going to collapse. Moody's was going to then issue a downgrade for the bank here. Oh, my VC is calling me, telling me to get my money out. Then the whole thing begins to roll downhill, you see. So the Fed interest rate hikes are part of the crisis, right? It precipitates the crisis by driving down the value of bonds and other assets held on balance sheets. So the Fed's the culprit here for precipitating it. But even more fundamentally, the Fed is the cause of this by injecting all this liquidity, you know, for 10, 12 years now, that can only be used for speculation, high-risk, long-term speculative investing by these financial institutions. The Fed then throws more money at it, creating the short-term solution, creates even a worse long-term financial instability. And they can't get off of this track, you see. They are stuck. When they have a crisis that they cause, they got to throw more money at it, and that causes the crisis next time around, even bigger. Right? This is what's wrong with monetary policy. And as I also argued in my 2017 book, monetary policy is broken, which means that even broken as far as the real economy, not the financial economy, the real economy is concerned. You know, Banking 101 says lower interest rates, businesses will then borrow from the Fed and invest and expand the economy and expand production and so forth, right? That's 101. That's the ideology of it, right? And so lowering interest rates will stimulate the real economy. Well, it doesn't work very well anymore. since 2008, and particularly, you know, we had zero rates for like 6-7 years. So Trump comes on, right? We had zero rates. And what did we get in the real economy? We got 2/3 of the average normal recovery from a recession. That's why I call it epic recession, you see. An epic recession, in my view, is where you have a big crash of the financial and real economy, and the recovery is very weak. It's shallow. It's short and shallow. It can't sustain itself, and it tends to fall back into stagnation or short, shallow contractions, recessions, and then recoveries that are weak. And it bounces along this way until you have another deep crash going on. And of course, the COVID was the deep crash, the second deep crash, right? And now we're seeing a weak recovery of the real economy, as well as all this financial instability and bubbles occur. I mean, look, what happened was the U.S. government in 2021 put at least $3, maybe $4 trillion of fiscal stimulus into the system, into the economy. What did we get in terms of real growth? Well, from December 2021 to December 2022, and it was the latest year, full year, we got 1% GDP growth after $3 to $4 trillion of fiscal stimulus. Something's wrong. Something broke, right? When you throw that much money and you get only this kind of a weak recovery. And at the same time, the Fed throws $5 trillion into the banking system, brings rates back down to zero again, and we still don't get a robust real economy growth. What we get is more financial bubbles, because the money is flowing not into the real economy, it's flowing into the financial side of the economy. That's the problem. Right? Lowering interest rates, the Fed, right, stimulates financial bubbles and financial overexpansion, but does not really stimulate the real economy, or does it less and less. Now, conversely, flip that thesis around, and when you've got the Fed trying to raise rates to slow the economy, bring inflation down, as we've had in the past year, it cannot raise rates high enough to bring inflation down. In other words, lowering rates did not stimulate the real economy, but the inverse of raising rates in order to slow inflation doesn't work very well either. We've had 5% increase in rates by the Fed here just over the past year, right? Most rapid increase in Fed rate hikes in history. What's happened to the consumer price index? Well, it's come down from about 8.5%. It's come down to about 6%. Well, that's not very much, you know? The Fed's goal is 2%. How are you going to get to 2% without raising rates to maybe 8, 9, 10%? Which you can't do. You can't do that because now it's clear, as I've said, a terminal interest rate above 5% causes this financial instability. So the Fed is between a rock and a hard place. Contradictions are severe in the capitalist monetary policy and the central banks. The central banks are at the end of their rope, as I wrote in my book in 2017 by that title, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes. And I proposed this thesis where I said that lowering interest rates does not stimulate the real economy, overstimulates financial bubbles. Raising interest rates doesn't bring inflation down. It causes financial instability. So the Fed has a narrow window in which they operate, and we're at the end of that window. So the Fed next week will one more time, I predict, raise interest rates, because it can't not do it. It would just be an indication that the Fed abandons its whole strategy here of trying to bring inflation down, which will never get to 2%. You know, I predict and have been that the inflation CPI is going to remain chronically around 4%, which means the Fed in the long run is going to raise their 2% target rate to 3 or something, right? They'll change it by redefining it. Right? But inflation is not going to really get down to where it was before. We're going to have to live with chronic inflation. But now, with bank lending freezing up and contracting, we're going to have a deeper recession. So we're going to have more unemployment at the same time, chronic high prices. That's called stagflation. We're going to be living with stagflation for some time, I believe. So, you know, the Fed is between a rock and a hard place. It's damned if it does and damned if it doesn't in terms of raising rates even higher. But the first mission of the Fed is all about saving the banks. It's even more important than slowing inflation. Yeah, saving the banks comes first. That's why central banks were created in the first place. The U.S. Central Bank was created in 1913 in the wake of the 1907-08 financial crash and panic, right? When the banks crash, right, they got to be bailed out. Well, you know, if the elected representatives in Congress have to bail them out, that doesn't go too well with their constituency, because it looks like they're bailing out the banks that caused the problem that caused Main Street folks to lose their jobs, lose their businesses, and so forth, right? So what the politicians did was create the central bank, the Federal Reserve, in 2013, the real mission of which is first and foremost to bail out the banks when they get in trouble, and they always periodically get in trouble. That way, the heat is taken off, political heat is taken off the Congress itself, right? Oh, the Fed did it, right? You can point a finger and blame the Fed. You know, it's a safety valve for the politicians, just as it is for 3 months. Okay, I think we're at the end of our show, and, you know, I haven't really finished the story. Well, maybe next week we'll see what happens here. Okay, I'm out of here.